Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We are now going to turn to Lecture 7 of Principles of Grammar. And this is basically our last new discussion of theory. After this, we'll be taking up exercises, grading and examination, doing a little bit more theory, but this is our last full new topic. And the topic is technically called diction. Diction, D-I-C-T-I-O-N. Diction does not mean, in its original use, it does not mean enunciation. If a radio announcer speaks clearly, you do not technically say he has good diction. You say he has good enunciation or pronunciation. Diction is the subject which studies the choice of words for the expression of a given thought or feeling. The choice of words for the expression of thought or feeling. If you make the right choice, you're said to have good diction. Inferior choice, inferior diction. Now obviously, if we only had two possibilities, silence on the one hand, or perfect expression of our thought in words on the other, there could be no such subject as diction. The subject exists because there are many intermediate degrees, many, many cases where you do say something, in some way you blurt your meaning out, but your wording is deficient in some way. It's approximate. It's inexact, it's confusing, it has the wrong emotional overtone, it's flat where you wanted something vivid, or vice versa, it's vivid when you wanted to pass over something quickly and without emphasis. The point is, your thought in any particular context needs to be expressed exactly, fully to suit that context, with the precise shading, feeling, emphasis necessary to communicate. Now, the ability to do this is obviously not at all automatic. It's a whole complex skill over and above the basic art of speaking or writing. It's the skill of using to learn language as a tool of very exact precision, versus simply blurting out or groping out some kind of semi-statement of what you mean. Now, all grammar in a broad way is concerned with the clear, exact expression of thought. But grammar per se, if you remember the definition I gave you in the very beginning of this course, is concerned with the ways of putting words together into a sentence. Diction, therefore, fills the last gap in our armament. It's the method of selecting the words themselves, not the putting of them together into a sentence, but the actual choice of the word. So technically, if you define grammar as the study of what word combinations into sentences, diction is not a branch of grammar. But because our basic goal in studying grammar is precision, clarity, exactness, and because that involves two elements, the choice of words and then the ways of putting them together, we need a separate study of the choice of words. And that's why diction is always included in a course on grammar. Now, it's common to observe that diction reveals character, so we may as well start by observing this elementary point. Remember, we don't mean enunciation. I quote from one author, "A man's choice of words is not accidental, but proceeds from his nature. Such as he is, such will his choice of words be. Listen to him for 5 minutes, or read a letter he has written, and you will know what manner of man he is. His breeding, his character, his outlook on life will be expressed by the particular words he uses." The fiction writer, knowing this, makes each of his characters use words that are, as we say, in character. Words befitting the personality and social standing of the character. One, for instance, habitually says, I ain't. Another, I'm not. And still another, I am not. One says, good eats. Another, good meals. And still another, savory repasts, etc. Now this is an obvious but important point. Your choice of words is a reflection of your character. It's obviously essential to the content of what you communicate. So we need a whole subject, how to choose the right word. That's diction. Now when we say right, we don't mean simply correct versus wrong. As in, for instance, ain't. That's obviously simply flatly wrong. But we have many other considerations in mind now beyond simply flatly right or wrong. We want not only the technically right word, but the most effective, eloquent, punchy, jazzy, colorful, with the right degree of emphasis, etc. Now, all languages, I may say, would need some kind of study of diction. But this is particularly necessary in English. And why do you think this is? What feature of English makes it a natural for a special study of diction beyond what normal languages would require? Yeah.
Our very vast vocabulary.
Gigantic vocabulary of English, simply mammoth, beyond, to my knowledge, anything in all history. Old English, which was the original language, spoken from about the 5th century to 1100, had, and that's the original English from which all of our language flowed, about 50,000 words. This was the language that we call Anglo-Saxon, was the language originated by the Angles and the Saxons, if you know this history, that came in from the West Germanic areas and kicked out the Celts. In any event, they had only 50,000 words. Middle English, which was the next 400 words, till about 1500, doubled it to about 100,000. And modern English has something over 500,000. Now, this is a 10 times increase over the fathers of this language who got along for 6 centuries without any of the rest of this. And this is simply stupendous. It's the result, really, of the fact, well, there's several reasons, but the major one is English has borrowed more words from other languages than any single other language in history. When the Normans invaded England, French was incorporated into English. Then with the Renaissance, vast amounts of Latin and Greek were brought in. Then with the English exploration and commercial development, every country and culture in the world began to pour words into the English language. And the result is it's acknowledged to be the richest, most cosmopolitan language in the world. And with such riches, you obviously need even more than the normal language some way to know how to get a hold of it. I know what you want to ask, some broader, deep question. This is just a general motivating introduction. I do want to say, though, one thing here, while we're on this point of history. Despite all of this borrow, the original Anglo-Saxon, that is the words that were coined in those first centuries, are still the core of English. And if you take any paragraph in any writer, the number of pure Anglo-Saxon words are between 70% and 90%. So that whole tremendous 450,000 borrowing constitute less than a fifth or less of any given paragraph. All the essential working words of the language are this basic Anglo-Saxon. Now this author, for instance, takes a simple paragraph and marks above it which words are Anglo-Saxon and which are anything else. And I'll just give you an example. All the following are Anglo-Saxon. Get all words from, or did, have some, of, from, which, could. You get the idea. It's all of those short monosyllables, which are the heart, the guts, the worker ants of the language, so to speak, as opposed to words like anti-disestablishmentarianism and so on, which our friends, in that case, are Latin, borrowing. Now, this is going to become important in the diction, because when in doubt, you have to remember that English is essentially an Anglo-Saxon language to this day, and that's an important stylistic fact which we'll get to later. But nevertheless, it's much more than that, and now we want to get to some principles of how to deal with this all. Now, the first very general issue to introduce you to is widely known, is the distinction between connotation and denotation. Connotation and denotation. A word has two dimensions. One is what it actually stands for. It's reference in reality. The actual entities, attributes, etc., that it includes. And that is known as its denotation. That is its literal meaning. Then, over and above this, there is another dimension, and that is the suggestions that the word evokes in the speaker, the listener, the reader. The emotions it calls up, the associations it brings to mind, the tone, the overtones, the color, the atmosphere, what you can call the feel of the word, over and above the specific reference. Now this arises, this dimension arises. That's called, of course, the connotation. It arises because we refer to things in a context, in a specific situation. And some words acquire, as an indissoluble part of them, an aura of the context in which they are typically used and in which they are suitable. And therefore, you can have a series of words which have basically the same denotation. They point to the same type of entities, but they have enormously different feels, overtones, associations. Now, you know this, for instance, just in your common sense experience, you would know that if you went to a formal dinner party and you found you didn't have a butter knife, for instance, you wouldn't turn to the hostess and ask if you could have a shiv. You know right away that would be fantastic, that's gangster parlance. Now, she would understand you. The denotation would still be a knife in broad sense, but nevertheless, the connotation would be radical and gangsterish rather than appropriate for a dinner party, and you would shrink from ever saying that. In logic, we'd give the example of the same entity, the same object could be referred to at a French restaurant is filet mignon, and that conveys the connotation of French elegance and aristocratic approach and so on. Or in a slaughterhouse, hunk of a hot dead cow, which is a radically different connotation, although the reference remains the same. And you know, of course, there are a whole series of words for the same entity, varying in connotation. Woman, chick, female, lady, and there's a whole raft of men. Women's Lit has proscribed some on the grounds of their connotation, etc. Now, you mustn't conclude that every word has some special connotation. Most words are neutral. You can say either they have no special connotation or the connotation is just neutral. If every word carried a special emotional aura, it'd be impossible to keep them straight. So the standard, solid, plain, everyday words that are the vehicle of your essential thought, walk, say, head, hand, is, but, the, are just plain, straight words. This issue comes up where there is a special connotation. Now, connotations is very broad. It encompasses all types of suggestion over and above the actual reference. It's not simply positive versus negative. Some people think that the only distinction between connotations is some words sound good and some sound bad, but that's just one element of the connotation. The basic idea of connotation is the context where the word would be used and is appropriate, the context that it evokes in the listener's mind. So there's poetic connotation, for instance, formal connotation versus informal, dignified connotation versus crude, adult versus childish, learned, technical, humorous, pompous. There's a whole vast array of possible suggestions. And the principle of diction then becomes, when you select a word, obviously you want to pay attention to what it means. That's elementary. We'll look at that shortly. But also you want to pay attention to the connotation, the vibes, so to speak, to make sure that they correspond exactly to your thought. Now, in a way, all of the rest of this evening is how to implement these issues of denotation and connotation. We have to start breaking up, first of all, connotation into some of the main divisions that come under. And first of all, there are three general levels of English. Three broad groups of words which have very different connotations. This is basically an issue of connotation. When I say they have different connotations, I mean there are three different kinds of situations in which you would typically use them. And the name of these three levels of English are formal English, F-O-R-M-A-L, colloquial English, you can spell it right, colloquial English. And what's number three? Slang. Now, I want to develop this threefold distinction. Let's start with formal English. Formal English is English appropriate for serious occasions. That's the way they usually define it. It can be written or oral, although the stress is in writing. Its main use is in writing. This is literary English. And if it's in oral terms, it's in some exalted, dignified, important oral terms. It's not ordering meat from the butcher, but it would be, for instance, addressing a society where you have a prepared talk, etc. Basically, though, it's English appropriate to the requirements of serious writing. Serious writing means you're talking about an important subject. You have something important to convey about it, and your writing is to convey the full clarity of your mind's understanding. Now, in this type of context, you're concerned above all with exactness, with literal accuracy. You never take shortcuts, because time is not a factor. The writer has plenty of time to prepare. The reader has plenty of time to pause and think about it. You dare not risk vagueness or misinterpretation or generality and approximation, because you're dealing with something by definition serious and important where you want your meaning to come across. So you take pains to spell out your exact meaning. Typically, for instance, the syntax of formal English is complex. You're careful to put the main emphasis in your main clause and subordinate the lesser factors so the complete impact of your main clause, you know, corresponds to your thought. You'll say whereas so-and-so, therefore so-and-so, etc. So it's fancier linguistic structure appropriate to convey your exact intention. By the same token, it's a higher vocabulary level where you're concerned with fine shadings, and as you're writing, you will pause to say, well, there are three or four words I could use here. Which do I mean? If something very bad happened, you may pause, for instance, and say, well, is this a catastrophe? Is it a disaster? Is it a cataclysm? Is it a holocaust? There's a whole array that will occur to you. You say, well, I'm only going to say it once. I want to get it right, and what do I actually mean? And so you're concerned with shadings between concepts. Now, this type of writing is indispensable for serious communication of serious ideas, but it is not desirable nor possible in all circumstances. Now, those of you who took the communication course with me will remember that I gave a whole lecture to the essential difference between writing and speaking. I'm not going to recapitulate that, but simply condense for you this one conclusion from it. In speaking, one must simplify enormously over and above what one can communicate in writing. You can put it this way. We always carry the crow with us that can only take in so much at a time. But in writing, he's got time to regroup, pause, go back, take it in, etc. In speaking, he's swamped every second. So he's potentially ready to give up at all times. And you have to make it as easy, as simple as possible for him to take it in. Therefore, your sentences in speaking have to be shorter on the whole. Your syntax has to be simpler. Good speaking is normally much more simple, Dick and Jane type, rather than whereas and therefore, which you just can't take in by ear. You give more pauses when you speak, more breaks for the reader, for the listener to catch his breath. And by the same token, you have to reduce your vocabulary level. You have to use words that are simpler, more familiar, easier to digest in one swallow. Now, by that fact, of course, you cannot be concerned with the exact shade of meaning. And, of course, it's not necessary because you're talking here in an ordinary daily context where those fine shadings are not essential. Therefore, your attempt is to indicate your idea in general terms. This doesn't mean you're sloppy, but it does mean you speak in generalized, what's called blanket words. So instead of trying to, you know, be very careful before you speak and say this was a cataclysm versus a catastrophe, and then you say it was a nightmare. That's all. Now, that's just one blanket, and it would apply to everything from F in the class to Nazi Germany, or you say it's awful. And that's just, there's no attempt there to discriminate, it's just a blanket, you get the idea of a general negative. It doesn't have the power of one of these much more specific words, but it conveys simply, right away, your general intention. Or take the word deal, D-E-A-L. Now this word, in some contexts, is formal English. For instance, what would be a verb used in which, give me a sentence with verb, with deal as a verb in formal English?
Yeah. I deal cards.
Dealing the cards. Deal the card. Or a deal of money. Deal means a large amount in that sense. But deal in the sense of the new deal, a fair deal, a good deal, a terrific deal. You know, the deal of the century, is there a, not a formal use, but what we call the next level, which is colloquial. Because there it's what? Short for who knows what? Transaction, bargain, trade, arrangements, pact, compact, contract. There's a thousand ways that people get together and exchange something or other, but we're not even attempting to specify. We use this little short, terse, all-purpose deal. So there's a degree of vagueness. But it's easy to take in and no strain. Now, when you get to that level, you're said to be using colloquialisms. Typically on this colloquial level, you make free use of abbreviations because your whole idea is make it short, reduce the units. So you say ad instead of advertisement, prof for professor, wasn't for was not, isn't for is not, etc. In other words, you use shorter, easier, more generalized words, liberally larded with abbreviations, and the result is a kind of breezy conversational style, which is fully acceptable for informal contexts. It's not bad, it's not wrong, it's not irrational, it's not even low. In fact, it would be impossible to speak formal English all the time. Just imagine you're asking someone who's going to the grocery market and you want to say, get a lot of butter. That's it. You just mutter, get a lot of butter. And you have to stop and think, get, buy, purchase, obtain, secure, acquire. If you have to start that, you'd have to give up bacon. And the same thing for log. Pound, container, carton, you know, etc. By the time you edited that, the cake would fall. In the colloquial context, you need some way of just blurting it out in a generality. Now, of course, if it was a legal contract, that would be a disaster, because there formal English would be required. If you can understand, if you signed a contract that said, if you do such and such, then you'll get a lot of money, that would be a complete disaster. But yet it works perfectly well, we'll get a lot of butter. And that's the difference between colloquial and formal English. Colloquialisms are appropriate where the dignity of a full serious statement is not necessary. Where it couldn't be taken in. Therefore, we have a whole vocabulary without the dignified connotation of formal English. So if you want a definition, it's usually defined as the colloquial level, reputable English for informal contexts. And by informal here, we mean it is not definitive statements on serious subjects. Colloquial is approximately a synonym for unprepared, extemporaneous, unstudied. And of course, it's the audience picks up right away your level of speaking. And if you're using colloquialism, they know you're not to be held to the exactness of a legal contract, so they take you in just the general way that you're broadcasting. Now, some words like deal can be formal in one situation and colloquial in another. Others are inherently colloquial. For instance, smash up, chum, spunk, okay. Now these words are when you use words like this, they're a signal to your listener in effect, this is not a treatise on philosophy or economics or a legal contract, etc. I'm just speaking off the cuff. This is not an exalted communication, so to speak. And you see the generality, which is the hallmark of colloquialism here. You, somebody is a chum, that's wide open, all the way from a acquaintance, a friend, a soulmate, whatever. And you see it has that breezy, unserious tone to it. It's not a very profound connotation because it's something you toss off in speech. Or spunk covers the whole gamut from courage, heroism, independence, strength, spirit, nerve, etc. And it's a kind of a glib, facile, you know, word. Now, I may say that sometimes people use colloquialism to deliberately to establish an air of closeness to another person. For example, you're writing a note and you write it in formal English and it sounds stilted. If you stick some colloquialisms in, it's less formal and sounds friendlier and warmer because the idea is it's just between you and me, you know, as we would talk. It's almost like the equivalent, the closest we can get in English to the French, you know, where they use the intimate tu versus the formal vous. Well, here, if you take your language down from the formal to the colloquial, you can get that effect in English. It's like taking your tie off with the friend, so to speak. And of course, then the next level would be taking your shirt off, and that would then go into slang. Now, there are often debates over where does colloquialism leave off and formal begin, borderline cases and so on, but broadly there are these two whole bodies. Let me give you just a few instances and see if you get the distinction. I'll give you the same sentence and you tell me which is colloquial and which is formal and see if you can get the logic of why from the nature of these two distinctions. Try and get here on time. Try to get here on time. Now one of those is colloquial and is accepted, but wrong informal expression. And one is formal. Another way of saying it is one is very literal and precise, and the other is approximate generality. Yes?
Try and get here would be colloquial.
Try and get here is colloquial. Did you all see that? Try to get here is formal. What's the difference? Literally speaking, try to get here names the situation exactly. All you can do is try. What you're trying is to get here. So that expresses your exact thought. Try and get here implies there's two things you should do. You should try and also you should get here. It doesn't make the logical relationship between the trying and the getting explicit. So it's like a vague association between two actions rather than the exact one. And that's a typical example of a colloquialism and of its relation to an exact expression. Or, for instance, what about stand-in versus substitute? Which is which?
Stand-in is colloquial.
Stand-in is colloquial, substitute is formal. What is the difference?
Just more formal. Substitute is an exact literal
concept. Stand-in is really a metaphor. It's a metaphor from, you know, one person standing in the shoes of another, which has been approximately generalized. And one key is, you will find in English, as a general rule, with exceptions, when you have a verb with a little preposition on the end, like stand in, or call it in a preposition or an adverb, whichever you want to call it, there will almost always be a one-word verb, which is the formal equivalent, like stand in would be substitute. For instance, held up, I was held up, I was
delayed.
Well, I didn't mean robbed, that's why it's colloquial. I mean delayed or detained. Show up, he didn't show up. Appear, you see, or arrive. Whenever you find yourself, one mark of this colloquial style is these breezy verbs with little prepositions at the end, whereas the formal verb is almost always not a prepositional verb. It's a single word which has an exact definition. It's not a metaphor. Now you can tell a lot of these colloquialisms. It was a snap course. I got to hit the hay. It was an awful wind. You can bank on it, you see, as opposed to what was the formal verb. You can rely on it, or count on it, etc. Now, you have to simply immerse yourself in these distinctions, but if you get the nature of the two, there's no problem. Now let's look at the third, which is slang. Now, slang is in a very different category from colloquialism. Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference, but basically, it's a very different category. Colloquialisms arise from an inherent need of human communication. That is the impossibility of picking each word in the formal context, as in get a lot of butter. And therefore, there has to be an informal vocabulary, you see. So this is something that we actually require. Slang, however, does not arise from an intrinsic need of communication, not an intrinsic need of the mind. What is the actual source of slang? Yes?
Insider's talk.
Well, it is insider's talk, but putting it in a more general way. Yes.
Ignorance of the right?
No, it's not only ignorance. More generally, slang comes from smart alecks or wisecrackers, comedians. Linguistic comedians, the way Fowler puts it is this. Slang is the diction that results from the favorite game among the young and lively of playing with words and renaming things and actions. Some invent new words or mutilate or misapply the old for the purpose of novelty, and others take up such words for the pleasure of being in the fashion. Many slang words and phrases perish. A few establish themselves. In either case, during probation, they are accounted unfit for literary use. He's a marvelously elegant writer. Slang, therefore, is regarded as inherently not reputable. A lot of it was the argot, or the special speech, the private speech of tramps, thieves, and all-purpose unsavory people, often originated as humor. rather than as any need to communicate a specific content. And that's why slang words are so typically devoid of definition, so vague in all purpose, because their main purpose is to be a gimmick, not to communicate something. So if you take a typical slang sentence, it gives you the illusion that some thought has been communicated, and then as you try to translate that thought into formal language, you find that the thought evaporates. You actually don't know what it is. For instance, if I say to you, his vibe show me where his head's at. Now you get some feel of something, but if you try to, you can try this on your own, if you try to put that into literal formal statement, you'd stop right away because you know exactly what is meant by vibes or what do you mean by where his head's at. They cover such an enormous variety of things, and if you try to define that statement, it actually will evaporate. You have to rethink the whole point. That's typical of a slang utterance. Colloquialisms, to some extent, are generalized, but slang, as a rule, is much cruder and vaguer. It's a substitute for any attempt at precision, even of a colloquial kind. And so you get words like, she's hot stuff, that was a lousy movie, swell, etc. Now the saving grace about slang is that it's generally very short-lived, 23 skidoo, you know. It dates very rapidly. If you read a passage written in slang about a decade later, it's virtually unreadable because the whole life is the faddishness of the thing, that is the inequality. And as soon as people start using it, the authors drop it because it doesn't have that inequality anymore. So in other words, it has no inherent role in mental life, and therefore time per se winnows it out. A few slang words ultimately work their way up and end up as formal English, and that's considered a great achievement if they do, usually because some concept is named that there was no exact equivalent of in English, in formal language. For instance, mob, which is now invaluable in discussing democracy, for instance, was originally slang, or cab, you know. But this is rare. And therefore, the rule is don't use slang in writing until it proves its durability. Now, for instance, to give you just a sense of the progression here, this is maybe not too eloquent, but I'll give you an idea. If man is formal, fellow, colloquial, Joe, a good Joe, would be slang. Or horse is formal, nag, colloquial, plug, or something like that, would be slang. Here is indication on the verb get of some of the uses or some of the development from formal to slang. The following are colloquialisms. Colloquial. Get there just the same. Didn't get to go. Get sick, get on one's nerves, and get left. The following then, after this now, are slang. Do you get me? Get wise to you. Get away with it. Get it across. Etc. Now you see those little words like get and take and so on have terrific value of being familiar, simple. Everybody knows them. So they're impressed into thousands of uses beyond their primary, and there's a whole scale of when is it colloquial and when are you over the line into slang. Now, I want one caution here with regard to this. I do not believe, and I don't want to imply, that it's always wrong to inject colloquialisms or even slang into formal writing. I would never make such a flat statement. It is by no means always wrong. The point is this. If you do it, you should do it deliberately, purposefully, knowing the element that you're introducing and why. Now, I do believe that colloquialisms and even slang is invaluable in writing philosophy, because philosophy has a real curse attached to it in the reader's mind, which is what? You know, most people's mental set when they go to read philosophy. Yeah.
Seems to be unconnected to day-to-day life on the
screen. Have nothing to do with reality. It's something kind of heavy, broad, you know, floating abstractions. It's ponderous and has nothing to do with anything. Now, in a case like that, you try to lighten it in every possible way and bring it down to the gutter, if necessary, in order to break that idea that this is something, you know, that only, you know, psychotic mathematicians would talk about. So I will, for instance, I have passages in my book where heavy passages on Hitler's philosophy and so on, with words like metaphysics and epistemology, etc. And then I'll put in some sentence like, but he couldn't get away with it. Now I know perfectly well that couldn't is not formal, because it's the end of apostrophe T, and get away with it is regarded as slang. But the idea is, bring it right down. Hit the reader's idea of, oh, this is something unintelligible, has nothing to do with the way I deal with reality. Bring it down to earth. And in that context, I don't believe the precision and formal content is sacrificed that much. And it can be effective. Now here again, this is, as in all these things, if you do this every other sentence, instead of having the effect of an occasional injection of an earthy element, it just shows that you don't know formal English and your meaning will not be clear. But appropriately used, it can be very effective. One thing, however, I would definitely suggest to you. When you do it, that is, when you use colloquialism or slang in writing, do not write a note to your reader to the effect, I know this is slang, but I'm doing it anyway. Now, a great many people do that. They don't actually write those words. What is the form that that note takes? They put quotation marks around the word, as if to say, well, of course, I'm in a much more exalted linguistic company than this. I would never use this word. Normally, I'm slumming. Now, that is an affectation. If you're going to use slang, use it bare and naked of any quotation marks. And if the reader thinks you don't know formal English, that's too bad. Either your purpose makes it clear, if you're that ashamed of it, leave it out and go back to the formal. But it's a very phony effect to use slang and stick quotation marks around it as if to say, well, I know better than this. Now, I'll take a few questions on this. Phil, you had a question?
I forgot my...
Yes, that's the whole advantage of postponing questions. Yes.
Curse words, they would be considered slang words, or they have a category of...
No, curse words would normally be slang, although some of them have formal...
Context,
yeah.
The best example of that...
Damn is a formal term.
The best example of that I...
But God damn it is not formal. Yes.
Talking about it.
The best example you were going to say of
the concretizing element you just spoke of, Miss Rand's epistemology, describing a child's development, conceptual formation, and then she says, I believe the words are, at this point all hell breaks loose.
Yes, yes. Now that's an excellent
example. I never found
a better
one of that.
She has this heavy, heavy passage on psychoepistemology. I think it's measurement omission and a whole bunch of hair-raising stuff, and then she says, at this point all hell breaks loose. And that is exactly that type of deliberate admixture. And she actually describes Francisco, by the way, as speaking this way, which I always admired. That method of speaking of precise formal English deliberately intermixed with slang. Yes.
Now I remember my question. It seems from what you've said, I can see the role that you can have in something such as philosophy tied down to earth. But from what you've said, I can't see how there's room for other uses of slang.
Wherever you have a purpose. Wherever you want to convey the feeling that the slang word conveys. It may have a connotation that's just right for you. And wherever that's the case, if you do it deliberately, that's appropriate.
Even in day-to-day discourse, though.
And especially in ordinary conversation, slang, remember, unless you are have Boswell following you, your conversation is eminently perishable. Therefore, you don't have to worry in your ordinary speech. You see, you can just go ahead and even use the slang of the day because it's all over after you've said it. All right, now I want to go on to another topic. Given you general background, I want to go to a different topic now. It's still within the general subject of choosing the right word to express your thought, and this is what to do when you're confronted with a number of synonyms, two words with more or less the same meaning. Now, there's not too much to tell you here, but maybe an example will help to elicit a common mental process. Let's suppose you want to say about a man, in some sense, that he's got a lot of ability. And a whole series, and it's in a formal context where you want to be precise. A whole series of words, let us say, immediately well up before. Now, I'm taking this as an example. Obviously, I could have given 1,000 different examples. But, for instance, he's clever, able, capable, adroit, shrewd, quick-witted, talented, gifted, a sharpie, fast, brainy, a mind like a steel trap, full of the old gray matter, etc. Now, or if you wanted to say he was angry, for instance. He's angry, mad, furious, irate, enraged, outraged, apoplectic, annoyed, indignant, displeased, throwing a fit, foaming off at the mouth, ranting and raving, you can go on and on and on. Now you know there are thesauruses which exist only to give you whole lists of synonyms, and there are also, thank goodness, things like this, which is a dictionary of synonyms. This is not a dictionary of meanings, but a dictionary of synonyms. It gives you whole clusters of related words, and then under each it tells you the main distinctions in the use of those synonyms. It's by this, the one I have is Webster's New Dictionary of Synonyms. It's a Merriam-Webster publication. I don't always agree with it, and it's not always enormously clear, but many times they put you on the track of a certain distinction between similar terms that you could not get from an ordinary dictionary, and this is therefore a valuable adjunct, this or if you could find some other one. Now, the question becomes, how do you choose? What principles can we name to help you choose among synonyms, besides just looking them up? Well, basically here, we first focus on denotation, because a great many synonyms differ in their denotation, in what they actually refer to, the actual meaning. And therefore, if you focus on the exact meaning, you will very often be able to, by that means alone, eliminate a number of candidates and pick out your exact one. Okay? Now thesaurus, I'm just answering your question, the thesaurus just gives you a list, so you don't know what word to use. It just gives you a whole set. And if one strikes you as the one you want, okay. But if you don't know the difference between four or five of those entries, then if you go to a dictionary of synonyms, they will say, the difference between A, B, and C is. And that's, so that this is, a dictionary of synonyms is more valuable for that purpose. Now, I say the first primary thing is to look at the denotation of the word. Now, if you're in the situation, such as we mentioned, you want to make some statement about this man, and there's a whole torrent of words occur to you, the first thing you have to do is in some form, by thinking, narrow the range of the possibilities before you. You have to therefore look to your own intention. You have to try and decide, well, what type of comment do I want to make? Now, schematic. In other words, no dictionary is going to help you if you just had that vast set that I gave you under a man of great ability, and you had no idea beyond that. Obviously, I'm including a whole bunch of different, even if related, kinds of points. So you'd have to go over and decide, what is more specifically your intention? You narrow your range. For instance, you want to compliment his brain power, specifically that. Or you want to compliment his intellectual speed, which is not exactly the same concept. Or you want to compliment his subtlety, his ability to pick up little tiny differences, which is not the same thing. Or you want to make a statement about his general capacity without narrowing it to his brain, his speed, or whichever. Or you just want to give an all-purpose praise without committing yourself to anything specific about the guy. Now, if you haven't, you see, at least up to that point, narrowed your own intention, no thesaurus or dictionary is going to help you because you don't know what you want to say. So the first thing to do, take the words that occur to you and see if you can abstract from some of them what is the type of intention you have. Now suppose, for instance, on this example, we would say our intention is just a reference to his general capacity without special emphasis on brain or speed or subtlety. We just want to say something about his general capacity. Well, now that already helps to delimit our reference. You see, we're going by denotation. We want to just refer words that refer to that. Now we look up in a thesaurus, let us say. We get a whole list. We look up under capacity. And let us suppose we pick out three that strike us as plausible. Now I'm doing this schematically just to give you an example. Able, capable, competent. Now all of those pertain to general capacity, not to brain power or speed, etc. Now, which one, let us suppose, we could give you more than that, but there's no use making it impossible. Do you want to say this man is able, this man is capable, this man is competent? Now, before I read you what a dictionary of synonyms says about those three, which of those three do you think is the biggest compliment, although all pertain to general ability? How many have an idea of which of those three is the biggest compliment? What would you say?
Competent.
You say competent. Who has a different idea?
Yeah. Capable.
Which?
Capable.
And who has another idea?
What did he say?
He said capable.
I'd say able.
You'd say able. Well, you would be in agreement with the dictionary and ordinary usage. You may have some specialized context in mind, but normally speaking, able conveys much more general capacity of a superlative degree. And I'll read you what the dictionary says. I grant you this is not ideal, but it does catch something which I recognize in the uses that I've seen. Able suggests ability markedly above the average. It often connotes power of mastery. Okay? Capable already is one rung down. Why? Capable stresses possession of qualities such as adaptability, resourcefulness, versatility, industry, efficiency, etc. So it's a little more specific. It's general capacities, but it doesn't convey this guy has reached mastery. It's just he's got some good qualities and maybe he'll be able to do good things with them. He's a capable person. It's a more modest, more restricted type of comment. And then competent is used to characterize a person or his activities in relation to a specific calling. So as soon as you say he's competent, it's almost like a narrower journalistic compliment. He's competent as a file clerk, but he's not an able person. See? Now, that's a taste, you see, of the type of distinction that you can get, and that I think is a reasonable distinction. Now what you have to do when you try to pick out among synonyms, first narrow your intention to a category. then get the main ones and see what distinctions. And then maybe you'll have to go back and narrow down again your intention and then go back, oscillate back and forth until at some point you know precisely what you want to say and have found a word whose denotation is precisely that. Now, if we had a full course on this, you'd have all kinds of exercises on words which are close but not the same, and then we'd have to study how you would establish the differences and when to use which. Liberty versus freedom, proposal versus proposition, audience versus spectators, I'm just taking them at random, etc. Some of those I stuck on the homework, so you'll get a chance to catch some of those at least. Now, in most cases, attention to the denotation alone by this method will basically guide you to the correct word. Connotation, therefore, comes in here. Not so much that you aim at a special connotation, but you simply have to be aware of the issue of connotation and keep track of the words that you select. Give them, in effect, a check as they pass through your mind onto the paper. Is this connotation okay? So, for instance, if you found that if the following word was fine in denotation, but you meant a compliment, you would hesitate to use it to say about this guy, for instance, he's shrewd. Now, why would you hesitate to say he's shrewd? Even though it does imply intelligent, smart, he has an ability, etc. But shrewd has what?
There's an implied pragmatism even, or possibly shady.
There's the implied possibility of an unscrupulous use, you see. And therefore, that gives a negative connotation. Not always, but there's that element. And so if you wanted a compliment, you'd stay away from a word like shrewd. What about brainy? Now, brainy doesn't imply a negative. And suppose you wanted to convey that he did have brain power. That was your intention. Brainy might do it as far as denotation, but what's the trouble with it as connotation?
You'd probably better use the word intelligent.
Well, what's wrong with brainy?
Snobby.
What's wrong with brain?
It has a slight connotation of being aloof or snobbish.
Oh, I don't think brainy suggests aloof or snobbish. Not as connotation. Maybe in your view of brainy people, yeah. But the word per se, I'm thinking of a different type of connotation that brainy would suggest. Yeah.
A connotation of egghead and not aware of other areas or something of that nature.
I agree.
Not really. Yes.
It's used by most people as a vice, not a virtue.
Well, I wouldn't even go so far as to say it's used as a vice. Well, what it's used as is an unserious statement of brain power. It's a light, colloquial way of saying he's got a big brain.
It's not something to be desired.
Right. It's not, does not have the dignity of something like intelligent, or a man of brain power, etc. Imagine, you could just imagine if God was introduced as the son, he was a brainy guy. Now that would communicate the content, but obviously the connotation would be colloquial, unserious, and so on. Yes?
For a word like being discriminating, what do you do when the meaning keeps changing?
Well, we're going
to be a good thing.
We're going to discuss what you do when everything changes next time. Next time, more or less, is the theory of how to deal in a Heraclitian world. The meanings keep changing and the rules keep changing, etc. And when do you go along and when don't you? That's really the subject that I'll remark on briefly next time. To answer just in a word here, if your context makes entirely clear your meaning, use it. I would never give up the word discriminating in a context where I can make it clear. But also, I would be aware that today, a great many people, well, for them, in much writing, I have to give up the word integration. Although integration refers to a philosophic, epistemological process of putting sense perceptions into a concept, you know, making a whole lot of parts, but if you say integration today, certainly to businessmen, that's finished, because then they have no, you know, they're talking only about affirmative action and so on, and you can't get them back. So you have to be aware of that. But I wouldn't give up the word in a context where I can make it clear. But you're taking us really into, I save that for the end, because the last question in any course is, but how long do these rules and so on obtain? Isn't everything constantly changing? You can't step into the same language twice. Now, in the process of choosing words, there's other kinds of guidance offered by typical books on grammar and diction. It really verges on style, but nevertheless it's helpful because the subject of choosing words is very broad. So supposing that you have picked the exact denotation and your connotation is appropriate, what other kind of variables are relevant in choosing words and specifically in choosing among synonyms? Now, we're no longer so much discussing how to express your thought as in effect how to alter your thought a bit and thereby improve its clarity and force. Now, depending on the book you read, you'll get 8, 10, 24 stylistic tips or suggestions. I have more or less condensed it all down to two issues, over and above, of course, denotation and connotation, as already discussed. I've condensed these supplementary rules down to, in effect, two. And I would give you them as follows. First of all, as a general rule for linguistic choice, find the right level of abstraction in your word choice. Find the right level of abstraction in your word choice. Words differ according to how concrete, how general, how specific, how abstract they are. Very often, the more concrete and specific a word, the more forceful and vivid it is. The more concrete makes a clear-cut appeal to the mind. The more abstract, many times, comes across as pale, weak, vague. Now, obviously, this depends entirely on the context. I would never dream of making a rule that you should always use the more concrete word, because if you tried such a rule, the first thing that would happen is what? You have to stop talking altogether. You go down to just grunting and pointing. You can't be more concrete than pointing. Language is inherently abstract. But, assuming the appropriate context, look at the difference between walk, the verb to walk, which in this context is abstract, as against all of the words which specify a particular, vivid, perceivable type of walking. For instance, ramble, stroll, stalk, tramp, stride, glide, mince, etc. Now, I repeat, abstractions are fine, they are necessary. I'm not saying the more concrete is always better. Where this rule comes up is really if you feel that your own writing is colorless, drab, you have that blah feeling in reading. That's the best way to describe it. There's something vague, pale, wishy-washy about it that you can't put your finger on. It doesn't hit anybody. One very helpful device is take some of the keywords and make the concept more concrete. Now, the price of doing that, of course, is great stress, force, emphasis to the more concrete word. And if your context doesn't bear that emphasis, you look ridiculous. For instance, in a normal case, you're talking to someone and you're writing, say, I walk to the store. And the walk passes right over, perfectly natural. But if you say, I strode to the store, without any other context, his mind focuses for a quick second on this, something funny, he's making a big fuss about the way he did it. You see, just by the fact of making it more concrete in a context where it normally wouldn't, it comes up it hits the mind. Or you can see it, you said, I suppose you said it in an ordinary way, you just said, went on, I goose stepped to the story. I tiptoed to the story. Now, where I learned this principle that the concrete takes on an enormous emphasis, first as I was editing the Objectivist or one of those magazines years ago, and someone had an interview, and in it they were saying that the person drank some coffee, and I thought, I'll make it more colorful. This is a complete side issue. And I edited it to consumed coffee out of paper cups. And I thought that'll make it a little more vivid. And the net effect of reading it was that what the person said receded into the background, because the consumed was such a strong, intense verb in that context that all you could see is this person, you know, swilling the coffee down. And his ideas were irrelevant. Now there you see, you want it the most neutral, drank without any emphasis. But there's a terrific amount you could do if you wanted to call attention to that by specifying the way he imbibed it, he guzzled it, etc. Now, you will find, I think, at least I'll put it in the first person, I certainly find that one of the worst problems of my first drafts is that they read enormously blah. They're filled with words like factor, element, situation, those general abstract terms which are required somehow to get the thought out, and they just sit like indigestible food on the stomach of the reader. They don't convey anything, they have no force, they have no color, they just sort of sit there. You can't chew them or swallow them or spit them out. Now, in such a case, try to concretize some. One or two words you will find is ample. Now, here's an example of the dramatic effects you can get with this. George Orwell experimented with a sentence from the Bible, writing it in the same basic content in purely abstract terms. Mm-hmm. Now I'll read you the translation and see if you even recognize. I assume you know Ecclesiastes, otherwise you won't recognize the original either, but you've heard part of this, I'm sure. This is stated in deliberately abstract language, but it's the same content. Objective consideration of contemporary phenomena compels the conclusion that success or failure in competitive activities exhibits no tendency to be commensurate with innate capacity, but a considerable element of the unpredictable must inevitably be taken into account. Now that is clear. That's not gobbledygook or, you know, double talk, but it's very abstract. It makes a strain to take it in. You have to really concentrate, and it has that evanescent, very abstract feel to it. Now, on the contrary, this is the way it was expressed in the original, in the Bible. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill. But time and chance happeneth to them all. Now that is very beautifully, eloquently expressed. It's incomparably superior. And of course, one is memorable and the other can barely be retained as you're reading. So, as a kind of an eloquent example of what you can do by going to a more concrete level, where appropriate. I keep stressing where appropriate, because if you just say the race is not to the swift and leave town, for all they know, you're only talking about running. So at some point, you have to communicate your abstract message. In this case, the thought that ability per se doesn't ensure a reward. You must make it clear, your abstraction. So this is not an all-purpose statement of eschew abstractions. On the contrary, what you have to watch is that your writing doesn't get drowned in excessive abstraction. Now Fowler, who's very good on this, you know, I recommend, as we're coming to the end, that you sometime read Fowler. You could just dip in anywhere. He's a delight to read. He describes a disease called abstractitis, which is right on this same topic. And I'll give you just a couple of examples and then his comment on it. Abstractitis is a disease of excessive abstraction. And here's his example. The effect of this disease, I'm quoting, now endemic on both sides of the Atlantic, is to make the patient write such sentences as the following. Now see if you can get this sentence without having it purported. Participation by the men in the control of the industry is non-existent. You get that? Participation by the men in the control of the industry is non-existent. Instead of, the men have no part in the control of the industry. Which is the same thought stated in concrete terms about specific men as the subject rather than participation as the subject. Or, the availability of this material is diminishing as against what?
This material has become less available.
This material is getting scarcer. Right. Persons and this is Fowler's summary. And so on, with an abstract word always in command as the subject of the sentence. That's the flaw. Persons and what they do, things and what is done to them are put in the background. And we can only peer at them through a glass darkly. Now, this is a very bad stylistic device. Very bad, very hard to fault. So in this context, the rule of not being excessively abstract means your sentences grammatically should be structured around the real actors in reality. The subjects of your sentence should be the persons or things that are acting. Subject is that which does something. And therefore, if your thought is to mirror reality, the subject ideally should be the concrete entities that act. It should not be some abstract quality. You shouldn't say their participation is non-existent. Because it makes the subject participation. And the actual subject in reality is they, the men. You should say they are not participating. Now, of course, there may be contexts where you want participation to be your focus. But as a normal rule, this placing of abstractions as the key subject element in the sentence is very, very undesirable. All right, so much by way of the rule of not being too abstract. Now, I might just point out that many books add another rule that seems to me to be more or less just an aspect of this one. They say use words that are more intense in meaning, strong, bold, colorful, rather than feeble, timid, ordinary. So, for instance, you'll get this kind of advice. Instead of happy, you know, I'll say the guy was happy. The guy, of course, being colorful. But I said that deliberately to bring it down because you're getting tired. But instead of saying the man was happy, they'll give you tribe, joyous, buoyant, elated, jubilant, cheery, ecstatic, sunny, etc., etc. All of these being stronger. But what's the reason that those are stronger? It seems to me partly because these are more concrete. They're specifications of happy, and therefore the connotation is more vivid. Partly also another factor is involved. These stronger words are less common, and therefore they tend to jump out at you. You don't normally say he was jubilant, buoyant, elated. You say he was happy. And therefore when you use one of these less usual words, it has a greater force. Words like happy are like love. Without the right context, they tend to just disappear as a kind of bromide. So, that leads us to the second general point, beyond the one about abstraction. And the best way I can put this is, avoid trite words. Many words and expressions are so overused that they do not register anymore. The sheer fact of them having been overused makes them contentless in most contexts. They may have had a literal meaning at one time, they may have been a wonderful word choice, but in effect, they've had it now, they're a bromide. And sometimes this is because they were so terrific when they were first discovered that everybody rushed in to use them. They were enormously eloquent. That's why a good part of Shakespeare is filled with bromides now, because when he first said these things, you know, the green-eyed monster and so on, it was so terrific, everybody rushed in to use it, but now everybody's been using it century after century, and it now doesn't register anymore. What do we mean by, what would be an example of a trite word or expression? Last but not least. Now you can imagine, the first person that thought of that, it's really pretty. He's got his alliteration, you know, two L's, and English is a language with a strong penchant for alliteration, which is not true of most languages, but in English speakers, all have loved alliteration from the time of the Anglo-Saxons on. So here this guy got two key concepts, a serial order and importance, time and significance, in two monosyllables with L, and you can just see the smile when you're ordering. Last but not least, that'll really get it. But of course, everybody did it, so now it doesn't mean a thing. It just loses, it's no longer reverberates as a clever way of hammering home something. It's just a dead canned expression. Clear as crystal, you know, all of this stuff. This sort of thing is canned, dead filler most of the time now, unless you have a context to warrant. Now, when I went to school, they gave us whole lists of trite expressions that we had to shun. We had to actually learn these expressions and learn not to use them. Here, for instance, are just the A's from the list that we were taught that you shouldn't use in one class. Abreast of the times, acid test, after all is said and done, all in all, along these lines, arms of Morpheus and one fell swoop in avenging justice. And we had list after list. These are dead, these betray poor style, they communicate nothing, etc. Now, our emphasis here, therefore, positively speaking, is trying to find something unusual, different, fresh, new, versus the standard run-of-the-mill word. Now here again, I must hasten to say that if you overdo this point, it's a disaster. You know, if you're the type of person that chooses a brand new, brilliant new word for every ordinary utterance, it becomes the most mannered, grotesque, and ridiculous as that dialogue, you know, of he said, she asseverated, he replied, she emphasized, he interjected, and those words swamp the dialogue. So there's a lot of places where you don't do this, obviously. Where appropriate, scan your language from the aspect of how much of it is canned and how much expresses fresh, actual meaning of yours. But if you have to choose between two sins, being trite on the one hand or being precious, mannered and artificially literary on the other, better to be trite. Don't get high flown. So this is simply a tip to brighten up your style where appropriate. Not an injunction to spend your time striving after phony defects. Putting it positively, it's best to be simple, direct, and natural, not affected. Now this is the point where I called your attention to what we said earlier about Anglo-Saxons. Don't forget the virtues of Anglo-Saxon English. These short words, these short, simple monosyllables are the essence of English. And you can, speaking English, convey a natural, direct simplicity with Anglo-Saxon that you cannot with Latin or with Latin derivatives. So if your intention in any passage is to be natural, direct, straightforward, which is, after all, really crucial, it helps you to know some derivative, some linguistic sources, and concentrate, hype up the Anglo-Saxon component, because that's what will convey it. The bulk of your style, in any case, has to be Anglo-Saxon, otherwise it would be impossible for us to take it in. So if you find that you've got Latinate expressions, transformation and ostentation, etc., a whole bunch of words like that, a bit of change and show, if you're going heavily into these Latin long word formulas or formulations, you have a true stylistic disease which wipes out the ability to communicate. Now, Fowler described this particular variant as love of the long word, which he regards as a separate sin. And let me give you just a few of the many examples that he gives of this, and see if you can see. There is such a disease as picking a long word for no reason other than that it's a long word. So you simply want to sound pedantic, learned, cultured, etc., at the price of a simple, natural, direct Anglo-Saxon statement. Now, for instance, tell me which is the phony word in this statement. The man dismissed will be offered alternative work.
Alternative.
Out there. What? What should it be? What is the Anglo-Saxon?
Other.
Other. That's it. Now, there's no reason to use alternative. Four syllable Latin root, which after all comes from alter, which means other, when you have the perfectly simple English Anglo-Saxon for other. Or take this one. This drug has proved successful in a percentage of cases. Now, what will be the Anglo-Saxon for that?
Number.
Well, you can do it even shorter than that. Instead of a number of or a percentage of, in sum, that's what sum is. Now, when you have a situation where a little three or four letter word like sum, which goes back to the beginning of time, you know, when the first Alfred hit the first native of England, they were talking sum, that is 1,000 times better than one of these complex phrases or Latin roots which are not necessary. Or, what about this? The greater proportion have by this time already dropped out. One word there.
Most.
Most is much better. But even if you had to say the greater, the greater part, the greater number. But when you get into these long Latin roots, you're already off the track completely. Now, in connection with this point about being natural, direct, I want to remind you of a point we made under economy. Remember, we were discussing economy because this point applies as much here as there. Avoid qualifiers unless they're essential. By qualifiers, I mean words or phrases like it seems to me, in a sense, on the one hand, or all those little words like rather, very, little, like this is she's a little stupid, so. All those words simply clutter up and dilute your style and make the meaning hard to take in. It comes under eliminate needless verb. All of these words were very accurately described in Strunken White's book. They say all these useless qualifiers, now get this for a statement, are leeches that infest the pond of prose, sucking the blood of words. And on that metaphor, we'll take a break. Now, we concluded the first part with a metaphor. which brings us to a discussion of the proper use of metaphors or figures of speech. This is always included in a general discussion of effective word choice. It's a topic worth saying a few words on. In effect, you can regard this as a way of concretizing a concept by comparing it to another different situation where the similarities stand out. Thus the leech analogy, for instance. It's a special way of concretizing an idea, a figure of speech, which does something briefly, if it's chosen appropriately, and very vividly and forcefully. It's a device, however, that has to be used with caution. Now, there's a lot one could say about analogies or metaphors. In a logic course, we discussed the use of analogies as methods of argument. But in connection with diction, we're concerned with effective word choice. And therefore, we're talking about the use of metaphors or figures of speech from the aspect of eloquent, forceful communication of your meaning. There's a lot of rules. Some of them are obvious, and I'm not going to belabor them, although I'll mention them. And one is not so obvious, and I want to stress it. First, some obvious things. Mixed metaphors are poor. Thus, Washington is a guiding light upon whom we should lean for support. Now, the two ideas in the metaphor, clash, mix, and collapse. So you get no net effect. Very often these are inadvertently humorous, and they give the effect of simply something ridiculous. Here, one book cites the following. Dante, an undergraduate, once declared, stands with one foot in the Middle Ages, while with the other he salutes the rising star. Now this speaks for itself. Next, you should avoid far-fetched or forced metaphors, even if you're consistent in carrying them out. For instance, the clergyman pointed to the corpse. "This is only the shell," he said. "The nut is gone." Now, this was not a mixed metaphor. He carried it out consistently, but it's obviously ridiculous. Now, some more real-life examples of poor metaphors because they're far-fetched or something else is wrong with them. This is a real example. "When a headache and he went to bed together, they were a noisy pair." Now the guy is groping for some kind of metaphor, but you can't translate that into a clear-cut meaning. Or, "The odd thing about truth is that it keeps changing its clothes." If you try to put your finger on what exactly is it saying, is it just the appearance of truth changes? And what does that mean? Or the truth actually changes? Or what? Then there is trite metaphors, as in poor novels. For instance, "Evening laid its blanket on the city." Well, you know, you've heard that 10,000 times, and so that type of metaphor doesn't communicate anything. Now, all these issues about avoid mixed, far-fetched, forced, trite metaphors. It's pretty obvious. The real issue lies in the use of metaphors when you do not even realize you're using a metaphor. That's what I want to explain. Much of our vocabulary is built on metaphors. We use them unconsciously a good part of the time, not as deliberate literary devices, but as ordinary words, unaware of the fact that we're actually using a metaphor. And this is very, very widespread. Take this sentence. "I won't let myself be stampeded to a decision." Now, one word there is a metaphor. Stampede. What is the literal? Whenever you say metaphorical word, there must always be a literal use, which you are extending by analogy. What is the literal root of stampede?
Overwhelmed?
No. Stampede does not mean overwhelmed. Stampede originally is a word for what?
Rush.
The rush hour for cows. Stampede originally is a mob scene for cattle. The frantic haste when they all converge. Now, someone saw that, and they thought, it's a terrific example of movement and pressure without the time for thought. It's just a vast concatenation of bodies. And they started to say, it's just like a stampede. And pretty soon the like dropped out, and they said, it is a stampede. And stampede now begins to have the connotation, the actual denotation, the meaning of a high-pressured activity, lots of motion and rush without thought. Only, if you do not know that stampede is still a metaphor, you'll be liable sometimes to utter a sentence like the following. I won't let myself be stampeded into stagnation. Now, that is a perfect, if you think of that, that's a perfect example of the fallacy I want to call your attention to. Stampede, normally, most people do not take as a metaphor. But it still has an aura of its original metaphor, its original literal meaning. And consequently, when you juxtapose it with a word like stagnation, it strikes you as peculiar, because that word like gives it a shot of life again, and you suddenly realize that was a metaphor. It isn't a literal primary usage. The metaphorical aura still clings to it and is capable of coming back to life under the right circumstances. And the result is, a word which you thought was perfectly straightforward and literal comes back to life unexpectedly as a metaphor and destroys your thought. You either have a mixed metaphor, or you have clashing images, like rushing around and sitting there doing nothing. Now, we can summarize the situation by saying there are three possibilities in this regard. One is a live metaphor, a real live metaphor, like the leech example, which is deliberately offered as such, as a rhetorical or literary device. The second is what Fowler calls a half-dead metaphor. Now, a half-dead metaphor would be like stampede. It's dead in many for many uses. It simply has the connotation of high pressure, etc. But it has that potential of being electrified back to life if you combine it with the appropriate word, in this case, like stagnation. And then there is the wholly dead metaphor. In other words, it once was a metaphor, but you can't bring it back to life anymore. It lost its aura so completely that the speakers of the language no longer have any feeling or sense that this was once a metaphor. And consequently, it becomes simply a purely literal term without reference to its metaphorical origin. Now, Fowler gives this example. The men were sifting meal. S-I-F-T-I-N-G was the original literal use. You know, put it through a sieve and get out ones of a different size. Now, what about, it told us to sift the evidence. Now he says, that's okay, but that's about 50%. Half alive, half dead. If you just say sift the evidence, it's fine. But as soon as you put it to, for instance, the evidence should be sifted with a microscope. The microscope brings back the fact that you can't sift with a microscope. It kicks the metaphor back into live quality and destroys the sentence. So there you may say something like, the evidence should be examined by a microscope, right? Where there's no longer any metaphor. Now, examine, who knows what that originally meant. Examine is Latin for the wheel of the tongue of a balance, and it meant originally to weigh. So when you talked about examining something, you talked about weighing. That was actually its meaning. But that's gone now. That is dead. That's 100% dead. Even Latin scholars no longer, when they say examine something, have any sense of determining its gravitational pull to the earth. It's absolutely gone, completely abstract, you see. Now there, I give you the example of the three levels. The literal usage, the half-dead, and the completely dead. And the point here is this. There's no problem with the live metaphors as long as you use appropriate ones. What you have to do is develop an ear for the half-dead, the semi-dead metaphors, to make sure that your context doesn't bring them back to life, with the result that you would have clashes or bizarre, mixed, inappropriate, etc. Yeah.
Can they only be brought back to life in a negative way, in an appropriate way?
Well, if you can bring them back to life in an appropriate, positive way, that's okay. But we're concerned with them as a flaw if you bring them back negative. Now, here are some. Just tell me offhand if you can see or hear where these metaphors are suddenly brought to life by the fact of being juxtaposed with some other element. It's a virgin field pregnant with possibilities. Now, virgin means untouched, and pregnant means lots of potential. Except, virgin had its primary meaning no sex, and pregnant, capable of conceiving because of sex, and therefore put the two together and they suddenly spring to life. Another example. What about this one? Now these are simple because I have to do them by your just hearing. This is a bottleneck which has to be ironed out. Okay. Now there again, you see, bottleneck and ironed out are two metaphors. Bottleneck is this narrow part of the bottle that's hard to get through, and it stands in general for an impediment. Ironed out is to flatten something, get it out of the way. But when you now convey the image of ironing a bottle and the thing disintegrates before you because their metaphors are kicked back into their real meaning. What about this one? Some editor, this is taken from Fowler, wrote the following. The following are the notes most consistently struck in the stream of letters we receive daily. Now, the notes most consistently struck is not a literal statement. A literal statement would be the ideas most commonly expressed. But the notes most consistently struck is a metaphor from
music.
And the stream of letters. Stream is flowing water,
right?
Now, you put those two together, the caller's comment is, this man is playing the piano in the water. You can't combine those two. Now, it gets much more tricky to perceive than these simple examples. I'll give you just this last instance of a more real-life type of situation. It's not this obvious. But I did not want to spend a long time analyzing this sentence because for purposes of pedagogy, you already had three and that's enough. It is impossible to crush the government's aim to expand the welfare state. Now there are two half-dead metaphors in there which can't be juxtaposed. What are the two words that are the half-dead metaphors?
Crush
is one. Crush is not the same as destroy. Crush is pulverized by huge weight, smashed down into the earth. That's one. And what is the other?
Aim.
Aim is not the same as purpose or goal. What is aim? That's a concrete, the archer pointing his arrow at some target. And consequently, that is also not a literal term. It's a half-dead metaphor. Now, you could use either of these alone, but the combination together conveys the attempt to bring a steamroller down on the process of pointing an arrow, and it just becomes unwieldy and communicates nothing. You could say, for instance, it's impossible to thwart the government's aim. That's okay. Or, it's impossible to crush the government's purpose. But when you put the two together, even though they're both innocuous and they're really quite dead, they're kicked back into existence. Now you get some examples of this in the homework. Is this something worth developing an ear for? Now, there's a lot of issues about diction that I haven't even tried to cover, that you can get from any reputable book. I haven't discussed, for instance, archaic diction such as forsooth, or regional provincialisms like he's plum loco, or the proper use of foreign words or technical words, etc. There's a whole slew of things, colloquialism, that we haven't covered, but these are things you can easily get from a book. I do want to take a brief look at this point, however, at the phenomenon of idiom. I-D-I-O-M, idiom. An idiom is an expression unique to a particular language which cannot be translated word for word into another language. An expression unique to a particular language that can't be translated word for word into another language. It's in effect a combination of words long established by custom with a peculiar grammatical construction which has a meaning as a whole that you can't figure out by analyzing its constituents. The simplest example in English, how are you? Now, if you took that literally, it means nothing, whatever. How are you what? How are you eating? How are you singing? But how are you? In what way are you? It just doesn't communicate anything. But we know perfectly well that the short, idiomatic way in English of saying, give me some statement about your overall condition as a preliminary to starting the conversation. Now, the French have a different idiom. If you say, come on, et vous, they will just look at you as if, what could that mean? They say, comment vous portez-vous, for instance, which would translate literally, and if you see beginning students of French, will translate that as to, in what way do you carry yourself? Which to the French would sound as bizarre as if you said in English, in what way are you? Because they don't mean do you carry yourself. They mean what we call, how are you? Yes.
Wouldn't how are you in French, their idiom for it be ça va?
Yeah.
How goes?
No, that's the answer.
Now that's a different thing. That's a somewhat different thing. The thing about an idiom is that it cannot be analyzed or parsed by normal grammatical rules. It's combinations of words in defiance of grammar that have meaning as a unit. And therefore, if you are parsing a sentence and you come across an idiom, it's the easiest thing in the world. You don't try to explain it, you just say that's an idiom. Which means it's a unit, that's the way English is, take it or leave it. Now, idioms are by no means necessarily colloquial. A good part of formal English is idiomatic. It stood him in good stead. In good stead is an idiom. The sooner the better is an idiom. Could you say the quickly, the slowly? You couldn't have two definite articles with two adverbs. And yet in this case, we're able to do it. Now what is the relevance of grasping idioms, the phenomenon, to diction? The relevance is very simple. You have no choice about idioms. it's a word combination fixed in the language by centuries of precedent. And therefore, it's not a question of deducing which combination you should use. If you're speaking English, you must use English idiom. And one of the most common violations of diction is unidiomatic English, a misuse of the English idiom. Now, to illustrate this for you, I'll give you the commonest misuse of idiom is in the preposition employed after a verb. A great many verbs, as an ironclad rule, require a certain preposition after them, if you're going to use a prepositional phrase at all. This is simply a matter of idiom. Maybe it's simply custom. And could, if you had been constructing the language, be entirely different. But the fact is, this is the way the language evolved. As it stands now, this is the way it must be used. The custom is definite, and you have to follow. So, for instance, if I say the word aim, as we were talking, and I want to put another thought after, I say, he aimed at going, or he aimed to go, which is idiomatic. At going is not idiomatic. At going is a violation of English idiom. English idiom, he aimed to go. Now, if you were writing a language, you could just as well have started it originally as he aimed at going. But that is not the way the language developed. You have to read a lot, and you have to be sensitive to what words commonly follow others in order to form these idiomatic units. Now, what is wrong with as a fact? And you say, as a fact, Newton was right. You can't say that. There is no such idiom in English. What do you have to say? As a matter of fact. Or, can you say, as regards to the law of gravitation? You cannot. You either have to say, as regards the law, or In regard to, but you can't say as regards to. Now those give you a simple, can you say, choose between right or wrong? Now that's not illogical, but you have to say choose between right and wrong. Now, on the whole, although there are some disputes, idiomatic usage is cut and dry and is usually given in the dictionary. Usually, if you look back far enough, you can find some basis in the history of the language for our present idiom. But the point now is this. It's no longer an option. The meaning now has been long established and has to be followed. So you can add another sin to your list. Unidiomatic English. And now, one last quick topic. And that is euphony, E-U-P-H-O-N-Y. Now we're getting down really to style, but to end on this very quickly. Euphony is the attempt to get a pleasing combination of sounds, physical sounds, in your word choice. Here we're not talking about meaning at all, but the actual sensory quality of the language that you use. Some language combinations are harsh, grating, irritating, and therefore they are said to be poor in this regard. Euphony means good sound in Greek. And if your sound combinations are pleasing to the ear, that's what you want here. Now, for instance, this would be considered a poor sentence on this ground, even assuming that in all other respects it was fine. Shamefully, she shared her shoddy seat on the shopping spree. Now, all the sh and s together is a very harsh sound on the ear. All that sibilant, hissing quality drowns the content of it. Or, the following is considered very bad on this ground. Any juxtaposition of two words ending in L-Y which is a hard sound, like completely unthinkingly, which a lot of people do, completely unthinking. That L-Y-L-Y combination is universally regarded as awkward, grating, and stylistically poor. It's a bad juxtaposition of sound. Now you can get a whole bunch of examples from standard books on it. The other aspect of euphony is avoidance of rhymes, unless you're a poet and it's deliberate. But inadvertent rhymes is terrible, because you make your reader focus on the words and rather than the meaning. The Senate will kill the bill sent over from the Hill. Or, the purpose seems to me to be to see a movie. To me to be to see. Now those are perfectly ordinary words, but the three of them together, you're in the ease rather than in the meaning. Now that's a quick hit and run on euphony. Yes.
What's the difference between euphony and alliteration?
Alliteration is the use of the same initial letter or sound in consecutive words. And that may be perfectly good. It may be perfectly desirable. It becomes a violation of euphony only if it's too many words or it's a grating combination. I mean, if you say Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers, that is not euphony. You know who's very good at euphony is Somerset Maugham. Very smooth flowing sound walls. Yes.
What is it called where you where people make an attempt to mask over a harsh reality by trying to
assume? Oh, that's euphemism. That's an entirely different thing. That's like calling somebody a mortician instead of a grave digger or something of that sort. Alright, I want to sum up now what are the main things that we covered and you can look for in the homework. Exact denotations, number crucial, most crucial. Appropriate connotation, including formal versus colloquial. Or formal versus informal. The right level of abstraction, this is just a summary of points we already made, so this should not be news to you. The use of fresh but natural language, that's the avoidance of the trite. The proper use of figures or metaphors, including half-dead ones. Obedience to idiom, and then you can throw in euphony. And those are the list of things to look for in the homework, and try and go over those sentences and see in how many different ways they violate one or more of these criteria. I want to conclude this discussion by putting in a plug for the dictionary, a dictionary. It's a very, very valuable book for vocabulary enlargement and for the whole purpose of diction. That's why it's called a dictionary. See, it has nothing to do with enunciation. It's the ary for diction. So it's a dictionary, you see. I was brought up with the idea that you live with the dictionary in the same room and never have to go to another room for a dictionary wherever you attend to work, that it's crucial to always look up any new word that you didn't understand. Made that habit part of me. I simply had that hammered in at home, and it's really, I think, very valuable if you want to inculcate it, because a dictionary, a decent one, gives you everything you want to know about a word. Its definition, its primary denotations, its connotation, the context in which it's appropriate to use it, its pronunciation, etc. The more vocabulary you acquire in this way, the better your ability to make shadings, distinguish one term from another, and therefore to express yourself clearly and eloquently. A proper dictionary will give you the usage, the history, everything you could want to know. So, if you're interested in this, what I suggest is whenever in conversation or in writing, a word comes up, if it's a word you completely don't know and don't care about, that's okay. Just let it go if it doesn't make any difference. But if it's a word you sort of get a sense of but you don't really know, and it's something you know is frequent and you're going to hear it or use it, make a point of trying to add it to your arsenal of words that you clearly understand, including its connotation and so on. And you will find in a short time you build up great proficiency by this method. Now, of course, it won't do everything, and if you just mechanically memorize dictionary definitions, it's hopeless. But nevertheless, it is. I'm very happy that I was taught that, and that that was emphasized so heavily, and I pass it on to you for what it's worth. I would really like to do some homework now. We still have homework for number 5. This is an essential question.
Well, I use the Random House on a Bridge. Is that a good, what would you suggest as a good dictionary?
Well, as a good dictionary, I use a combination of 3 dictionaries. If you ask what's a good dictionary, I use something like the Random House, even a Bridge, you know, the college, because you want something short, up to date, that give you the latest, and that's reasonably sane, and I think Random House is that. I supplement that, though, with 2 other types when it's really an issue that I have to really study and grasp this word. One is a much, much older dictionary, because very often the definitions of key terms are better in much, much older dictionaries, I mean from the 20s and 30s. And then, in addition, I have the Oxford Unabridged. Pardon?
The middle one you just...
Well, I have, I can't even remember the name. I went to one of those old used bookstore place and asked for one of these giant things from the 20s. Yes?
No, I just thought perhaps it was the second.
The second Webster?
Webster second.
Well, the Webster second is certainly infinitely better than Webster's third. But I'm not that much of an expert to be able to say exactly which. Any big old one, look up words like capitalism, selfishness, etc., and you'll see how slanted it is. And the old ones are generally better, but the new ones are more up to date. So between the two, and then the Oxford gives you an unlimited essay with citations from the 14th century on the word, if you need it. But those are heavy, they're multi-volume, and that's only an extreme unction, so to speak. All right. Now I want to go to the homework left from number 5. We're way back on verbals or pronouns. And we have number 9 to do here. Does everybody have a copy of that? There's copies up there, somewhere. All right, each of us who is now living is destined to witness the rebirth of reason. What's wrong with this? Yes.
Is should be are.
Which is?
First is.
The first is should be are. It should be each of us who are now living. What?
Who are now living is an adjectival clause modifying us.
The referent is us, correct, and therefore it's plural. Now you could theoretically have had a sentence, each man who is now living. But once you bring in the us, the most natural interpretation would be, it's the us who are living. And therefore, the who are living goes with the us that should be plural. This is a simple example of the number of a verb to agree with the antecedent. Number 10. Taken from Forster and Steady. 3 shots rang out, 2 of the servants fell dead, the other went through his hat. Now, does anybody remember back to pronouns? What is this? Which pronoun is here ambiguous?
Other.
Yeah. Other. And what does it seem to refer to?
Shiloh.
The other is servant.
The other servant.
And what does it actually refer to?
Shot.
Shot is too far away. What is that called then?
Progress.
Not progress.
Remote.
Too far away is?
Remote.
Remote reference. Remote and therefore ambiguous reference. Number 11. Now we're marching smartly through these with or without your complicity. Number 11. To win the election, a proper campaign is needed. Makes it sound like the campaign is going to win. What's wrong with this? Yes.
You need the right object.
The right subject.
Right subject.
You mean the right winner.
Right.
And therefore, as it stands now, what's the error? It's not clear what to win the election is to be taken with, right? It's not to be taken with the campaign, but the candidate who isn't mentioned. Therefore, it's an element which just sits there without being connected. What is that called?
Dangling
what? No, it's not a gerund. It's not a participle. To win. It's a perfect infinitive. It's a dangling infinitive. And to reconstruct it, you'd have to say, to win the election, a candidate must wage a proper campaign. Number 12, a trickier one. My worst fault is my inability to express myself emphatically on paper, but this is not true and I'm speaking aloud. As a perfect example of a phallus. What phallus? What word is ambiguous there? Now you know from the instructions it's either a verbal or a pronoun. This is the culprit. What? What is the referent of this? Is it the broad reference? The whole thought is not true when I'm speaking aloud. Well, what would that mean? Does it mean my inability to express myself emphatically on paper disappears when I'm speaking aloud? I mean, I can do it on paper too then, or what? You see what I mean? It's ambiguous because you don't know what the this refers to. Or does he mean to say, I don't have trouble expressing myself emphatically when I'm speaking aloud? The this is a vague, it's what's a broad reference to the whole proceeding, but you don't know what part of the proceeding. And now number 13. We say, rewrite without any pronoun. How many pronouns are there in this as it stands? Now let's see by a show of hands. How many pronouns in this passage, number 10, number what is it? 13. How many pronouns? How many?
Six.
You say six. How many agree? How many disagree? How many do you say?
So far I've got six. I'm still looking.
You say two?
No.
No, not different. How many pronouns? You say five? No, you missed one. Six is correct. Let's count them. When it, number one. Lost it, number two. It, number three, was too dark. It, number four, seems to do
anything.
Five. Number five, that's the indefinite pronoun. About it, number six. Now here, the sin here is all these multiple its. The anything isn't a sin, but just for the heck of it, I said write it without any pronouns as an exercise. Same idea. This baby lost a rattle. At the time it was too dark. We aren't sure. It seems. And yet we couldn't do anything about it. Now, did anyone find a way to express that with no pronoun? Yes.
At the time of the loss, the darkness apparently prevented the child from conducting a search.
Well, that's not bad, but you left out one very crucial thing. I want this exact information.
Oh.
What did you omit? A search for what?
The toy.
The toy lost by whom?
The baby.
You left that out, right?
I said the child.
By the child. All right, I don't care about baby or child. Now read it again and stick that information in.
At the time of the loss of the toy, the darkness apparently prevented the child from conducting a search.
Well, what did you leave out? The passage gives you more information. The passage tells you what? That the baby lost the toy or the child. You left that out. Your sentence is compound. You have to get the ability to edit while keeping the same content. Your passage is, could be Einstein lost the toy, but the baby couldn't conduct a search. We want to communicate the baby lost the toy. And it seems that we can't because it was dark. Arlene, you have one?
I didn't change it very much. When the baby lost the toy, the room was too dark to make a search. I left out a scene.
The room was too dark to make a search. Well, that's ambiguous, you see. It makes it sound like the room is doing the searching. The room was too dark to permit a search.
Or to allow the baby
to... So say it again. When the baby lost the toy...
The room was too dark.
Yes.
No, that's not really either.
The room was too dark to permit a search. That's okay. But now to get in the uncertainty. The room seemed to be too dark to permit a search. And we're sort of leaving slightly up in the air a search for the toy, but it's pretty obvious, so that's okay. Who had something else? Marion.
The baby lost the toy in the dark. Consequently, the toy was not found.
Well, you gave us a dip. First of all, you didn't bring in the possibility. It seems right. Consequently, you'd have to say the toy seemed difficult to find. But now you are avoiding the problem of pronoun by just repeating the noun, which is okay. But it's better to do it without. Now, I don't want to spend the whole time on this. I'll just tell you what I had. I do not put this forth as deathless prose. On the contrary, it's very awkward, but it just is another way of meeting the assignment. But the one we had already was okay. I had, finding the toy lost by the baby seemed to be impossible because of the darkness at the time. I made a gerund out of it, you see. It's just to show you that you can do it. Now, you may say, why would you want to do it? Wait till you write sentences filled with it's, and you've got to get rid of something. All right, let us go to the homework on number 6. Now, this is basically a homework on commas. In fact, it's entirely homework on commas with one possible exception, not covered in the instructions. There's one case where a mark other than a comma would be superior. But leaving that aside, what I'd like you to do is tell me, in each case, the comma is wrong because, or it needs a comma because. And just give us the relevant rule or principle. All right, number 1. Let's read through it. Okay.
We did not see the woman in rags. You can leave the comma out.
Must leave the comma out. Why?
Well, I don't know about must. My reason was that it was not necessary because it was a short statement.
No, that's not sufficient at all. There's a much more specific reason than that. You cannot make a rule that's short, does not require commas because many sentence modifiers like however or therefore must have commas and they're only one word. Brevity is not an absolute, but here something else is. Yes.
It's not a compound.
It's simply a compound object. And a compound object is not broken up. It ain't more than a compound subject or a compound verb. Now, what other modification in number 1? Going on to the next sentence. Yes.
Comma between careless and shy.
Comma after careless. Why?
It's two adjectives.
Well, two adjectives is not yet an explanation.
Describing the same thing.
Well, two adjectives of equal status, each to be taken with apparel. It's careless and shoddy.
Okay.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And the test is, could you invert them? Shoddy and careless, yes. And therefore, these are what we called? What?
Coordinate
adjectives, a series of coordinates. And in that case, they must be separated by commas. Who put a comma after bright or public? Well, that would be wrong, although those are also adjectives. But here, the thought unit is public dining room, even though that's two adjectives, public and dining, before the noun. But it functions as one unit, and they're not coordinate. It's not like a bright room and a public room and a dining room. See, otherwise it would be commas after them, like with careless and shoddy. So it's only a comma after careless so far. What else in this first one? You're in.
After room.
Comma after room is required. Why?
Because there's two main clauses.
Two main clauses.
Joined by conjunction.
Two main clauses. What else? Back row.
After that.
Comma after that to separate all things considered. Why?
Because it's just an aside.
It's an aside, right.
So you feel it's not too far.
And you would misread it. We do not feel that all things are, and then we suddenly realize, oh, that doesn't even go with the that, you see. Okay. Number two, exercise on restrictive versus non-restrictive commas. Yes.
After Jones and after week.
Well, let's take it one at a time. Comma after the first Jones. Why?
Well, they go together because that's my positive. You can take it out if you
want to. Now wait a minute. Tell me where you want it. We're doing number two. You want to put a comma in after the first Jones?
Yes.
Well, that's not an appositive, it's a whole phrase.
Well,
it's an adjective whom I called last week. That's not an appositive. An appositive is a substantive. A noun is an adjective. This is telling you something about Jones. Why is a comma required? You're correct. A comma is required after Jones. Why? Yes.
Non-restrictive.
It's non-restrictive.
Not very likely that there'd be
right.
two Jones.
Well, if there were two Jones, you'd have to say the.
Right.
You'd have to say, the man whom I saw yesterday told me that. The Jones whom I called last week.
Right.
In which case, then, you'd put no comma, and that restricts it. But here it's just Jones, presumably in the context he's brought fully into existence. Then you say, by the way, I called him last week. But that's not restrictive of him, so it's a comma. On the other hand, there can't be a comma after man, because the man, you don't know which man. See, it's not a proper noun. It's the man I called yesterday told me that Jones. And so I deliberately put two clauses, almost the same meaning, but one is restrictive, one is not. Now, go ahead. You said the next comma was after week?
Yes.
Well, that concludes Jones. Yes, that's the other half. Jones, comma, whom I called last week, comma, was out of town. That concludes the non-restrictive. What else? Continue with that. Continue with number two.
Which ones I put.
Number two it was.
Is there one after another?
Yeah, absolutely. Why?
Okay. Why does couldn't tell because I use black ink?
Oh. Why is there nevertheless take a comma?
That's an aside.
It's a sentence modifier. Any sentence modifier is set aside. It modifies the whole sentence. Anything else? Yes?
There should be one after Jones' books.
Books, comma. The last books, right? Not the first. Because the first is I made a list of, not I made a list of books, and by the way, they influenced me. It's I made a list of books which influenced me, so it's restricted. But in the last, it's not I always buy Jones' books which influenced me as opposed to Jones' books which didn't. If I always buy Jones' books, and by the way, they influenced me. So there, you must have a comma after books. Now you see here, I deliberately tried to construct two cases of the same content, one restrictive, one non. How many got number two completely correct? How many got it wrong? Well, better luck next time. Number three. Yes.
Remove both commas.
Remove both commas according to one rule.
There's a negative sense implied between the commas.
Correct. It's a negative adverb. Negative adverbial phrase. And it makes it sound as though he has given Speeders a ticket. It makes it too parenthetical, and negation is of the essence of a sentence. It's not just a normal adverb. Number four. Yes.
Neither of the changes suggested by the board, you take the comma out.
No comma after board. Why?
It's breaking up something. It's
breaking up two essential elements. What?
Changes.
What is another of the changes suggested by the board? What is that function in the sentence? The subject or predicate?
Subject.
Subject. And what is? The verb. Well, it's the predicate of the verb. So this is putting a comma between subject and verb, which is one of the cardinal no-nos. What else in number four? Yes.
It seems should be set up by commas.
It is set up.
Oh, I'm sorry. The next one after that is the comma after work, which should be taken out.
Comma after work can be deleted. Why?
Yes. Because the adverb clause, when he reaches his senior year, doesn't need to be.
Right. An adverbial modifier, a modifier at the end of a sentence, does not require a pause, unless you have some special situation of emphasis. You're not setting off the main clause, which is yet to come, because it's finished. And you're not putting it apart from the rest of the thing in the middle, because it's not in the middle. So there's no way it can confuse you. Number five. Yes, David.
I put a comma after France.
Well, wait till we
do. I know.
You missed an awful lot before that time. Mm-hmm. All right. Did you have your hand up?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
I would use dashes there. They brought our meal with a dash.
Yeah, there's too many things in commas. You lose the structure. So it would be better after the which to have a dash, and then after Italy to have a dash. Because then you have a very long aside, and when you have a long aside, itself broken up into units, you get lost as to where does the aside begin and end. And therefore, if you put a dash after which and a dash after Italy, it tells you that hotter, cold, sweeter, spicy, made of tomatoes or baked with cheese, the whole business is an aside, because the main idea is which we ate. And that's one of the main functions of a dash, is to separate a complicated aside, which itself has commas within it. But that is by no means the main thing in this sentence. There is a crucial comma omitted here. By the way, no comma is required or would even be proper after France. Entirely unnecessary.
Well,
it's very clear as stated, and your comma is after each unit. Hot or cold, sweet or spicy, made of tomatoes or baked with cheese. There's nothing a comma would do there.
You have four items in your
three.
Aside.
Three in your series.
Four.
No, sir.
Hot or cold, sweet or spicy.
Tomatoes or cheese. France is not an item. It's where the tomatoes came.
No, I didn't say that. Hot or cold is one. Sweet or spicy. Made of tomatoes from France. Baked with cheese is four.
You're not following the structure. Hot or cold is one alternative. It's either one alternative or two possibilities.
That's one.
That's one. But then either side of the or makes it still one.
That's what I said.
And sweet or spicy is one.
That's
and
two.
Made of tomatoes or cheese is one. It's just a more elaborate discussion of the alternatives. It's still only one alternative. So you have three and they're in the same unit. And on parallelism, you shouldn't stick a comma in there. But there is a comma required.
But
after...
Wait. It gets too long, and you don't...
It's not too long. It's perfectly simple.
Because the first two are so short. That's
doesn't make any
the
difference.
Contrast in them.
You don't put a comma in because something is long. You put a comma in to mark a structure which is otherwise unclear. And there is no way to misread this here. And in fact, if you put a comma in after whether or, etc., you'll just put the reader into an expectation of something that doesn't come. But, as I say, there is a comma. Go ahead.
After uncomplainingly.
No, you don't have to separate all day long into the night, because that's an adverbial modifier at the end. And at the end, you can go on. There's no structure to confuse, because we've already had the structure. There is a crucial comma here required. As it's worded now, there are two sets of meals. There are those meals which are either hot or cold, sweet or spicy, made of tomatoes or cheese, and those which aren't. Now that does not seem to be his thought. It seems to be he ate the meals. And then you go on to say these meals were made of so-and-so. In other words, this whole thing in dashes is non-restrictive. And therefore there should be a comma after meals.
Dr. Pickup, isn't the non-restrictive clause actually which we ate complainingly all day long? Implying, therefore, without the comma, that there are meals which we didn't eat complainingly.
That's correct. You're right. You're correct, and I wasn't. The actual non-restrictive clause is they brought our meals, which we ate uncomplaining. Now, if there's no comma, it implies there are also meals which we ate with complaints. That's a much more accurate way of putting it.
Huh?
You
put the dashes in there, just it's not part of the structure of the
sentence. All right. I don't think we'll finish all of this, but let's get through some of this. Yes.
With the uncomplainingly all day long, is it clear as to whether it's the eating uncomplainingly or the eating that's going on all day or the non-complaining that's going on?
Presumably both. Number six, taken from Fowler. You could see from the literary quality of this example that I didn't make it up. I mean, the poetic quality. To get a few new faces here. Yes, what up, yeah.
Well, I put in a serial comma after birth.
Perfect. A serial comma after birth required. Why?
Because the pine is rugged and the silky texture.
Otherwise, it'd make it sound like the silky texture goes with the birch and the pine. Number seven. Back, yes.
Before to her lover and after to her lover.
Why in the world? To her lover is what relation to confiding?
The object.
No, well, it's a certain kind of object, the indirect object, right? Confiding a secret would be the direct object, and then to whom? Who is the beneficiary, the recipient? This is the indirect object. There's no rule at all that an indirect object requires commas. In fact, the contrary. Without some special circumstance, an object, direct or indirect, goes right into its verb. So there would be no commas at all.
What if your thought was that it was important that she was confiding the
truth?
Well,
if it was important, you could put commas in, but it's not a good sentence. Then if it's important, you have to structure it in such a way, really, to show that it's important. You have to say, put it in your main clause. I saw her confiding what she thought the truth was, dash, to her lover, something like that, to jump it out. But to take an unemphatic placement and stick commas around it is a poor way of achieving it. So I would not put commas around it there. But there is a case, something wrong with number seven as it stands. Yes?
I took out the two commas.
Two commas around she thought are wrong. Why? According to what rule?
It's restrictive.
No, that's not the rule here. Yes.
Mental state.
It's the parenthesis of mental state. Remember, it's what she thought, what he believed, what I said, what they held. You never put those in commas. All right, let's at least do number eight.
Can I ask the question about...
Okay.
I'm not sure whether she's walking towards the building or I'm walking towards the building.
By the structure of the sentence, it has to be I. Otherwise, it's a jangling motto. The participle always is taken with the first word in the subjective case. The first noun. or pronoun. All right, let's do number 8, but then do not get up in an exodus because I need 2 minutes to distribute one final coup de grace. Now, number 8 is what? This is an obvious one. I think it's obvious anyway. Yes.
To begin with, Tom, my uncle had an...
You have to have a comma after with, correct. What?
To prevent misreading, you could say to begin with my uncle.
Very good, to prevent misreading, otherwise it's to begin with my uncle. And what else?
While he was cooking, comma.
Comma, because otherwise it makes it sound like his dog is the object of cooking instead of the subject of drumming. Okay. Now we'll do the last 5 next time. And we will do the homework from number 7 next time, and we'll have a bit more theory and... We will let you ask any final questions you have on grammar as such or anything more or less connected to it. And we will do one last thing. I am about to hand out a final examination. If you're hearing this on tape, I may say you already have this in your... material that was given when you enrolled. This exam tests, if you wish to test it, your knowledge of the course as well as I can do it. It's only for you. You are not required to grade it, to do it, or to reveal your grade. You are going to be determining your grade, not me. Next week we'll go over. There are 2 questions. Since you are grading it, write the answers any way that you find convenient, as long as you know your intention. Write it on the paper, on a separate sheet, I don't care. It's open book. Memory is not required, because there's no reason why you should memorize these things. If you can look it up, good luck to you. One is pure theory, as you'll see, testing your knowledge of various concepts. One is a long passage, or fairly long, that I wrote, filled with grammatical errors of various kinds, asking you to name the error and state how you would correct it. Ideally, you could make 100 points, or there's a certain bonus. You could even go up to 111, theoretically. What I would like you to do is give yourself approximately an hour for the whole thing. This is a test for you, so you can take 4 hours if you want, but doesn't mean quite as much. Normally you should be able to go through this in approximately an hour and 5 minutes. The less you consult with anyone else about it, the better. The more you discuss eagerly all the answers on the way home, the less it has any significance. So I suggest you put it away now, not even look at it till you get to the privacy of your own home. And next week, after we finish a little new theory and all of the accumulated homework, we're going to go over this. Some of it is interesting examples in its own terms. It's like a refresher, an overview. And you'll be able to end up with an actual numerical grade. So bring it with your answers next time. Okay, I'll see you next time.